You can turn to the book of Revelation, chapter 9. We're going to continue our studies with the trumpet judgments. We looked last week at the sounding of the fifth trumpet, which is the first woe trumpet that's described in Revelation chapter 8, verse 13. The last three trumpets are the woe trumpets. And we see with the fifth trumpet there were locusts that were released from the pit of the abyss. I don't believe these are literal locusts, because when you look at the description that we're going to look at tonight and the power that they have, it does not fit with the typical or normal locust that we would think of. These were some type of demonic creature, I believe. They had been kept in this pit, or the pit of the abyss, for this specific time of judgment, according to 2 Peter chapter 2 and Jude verse 6, it seems to be the case. And so when the pit of the abyss was opened, we read that there was smoke that arose like that of a great furnace, which indicates that this is another of those judgments that God is bringing upon the earth, that is a fiery judgment. It says, the sun and the air were darkened because of the emergence of the smoke from the pit. And out of the smoke, it says, locusts came up upon the earth. Let's look at, let's pick up verse 3. Then out of the smoke locusts came upon the earth, and to them was given power, as the scorpions of the earth have power. They were commanded not to hurt not to harm the grass of the earth, or any green thing, or any tree, but only those men who do not have the seal of God on their foreheads. And they were not given authority to kill them, but to torment them for 5 months. And their torment was like the torment of a scorpion when it strikes a man. So these locusts, when they come up out of the pit, they're given authority. They're given the opportunity. They're given rain to do something. But it's not the typical thing that you would think a locust would do. Usually when there are plagues of locusts, like there was back in the book of Exodus, they destroy all the green grass and trees and plants and so forth on the earth. But these are not given authority to harm anything on the earth, any green thing at all. They are given authority to harm and to torment mankind. And that's exactly what we saw was the description of the woe trumpets. It was upon the inhabitants of the earth. They were not given authority to kill men, but to torment them for 5 months. And the only ones they could torment were the ones who did not have the seal of God in their foreheads. So this would be talking about unbelieving mankind upon the earth, the majority of who were a part of the kingdom of the Antichrist and were followers of him. They had authority to inflict torment. It says torment like the torment of scorpions. Scorpion when it strikes a man. The torment that they inflict, if you look at scorpion stings, and I'm not an expert on them, I've never been stung by one, don't ever want to be, but evidently there are different degrees of pain associated with different types of scorpions. For instance, a non-dangerous scorpion is described this way, like it's like striking your thumb with a hammer, okay, that type of pain. A dangerous scorpion is, comparatively speaking, it's like hammering a nail through your thumb. The difference in pain is that severe. An example is the Arizona bark scorpion. I looked this up. I have no personal acquaintance with those scorpions at all. I don't want to, because it says the venom that this scorpion produces results in severe pain at the site of the sting, with numbness, frothing at the mouth, difficulties in breathing, muscle twitches, and convulsions. Now, that's beyond just the pain of a typical scorpion we would find around here. Someone has put it this way who experienced this. He says, it was like someone had stabbed my leg with a red-hot poker, and my leg just didn't want to function. He says, the pain was awful. It was incredible. It was inescapable, shooting in both directions, up and down my leg. Now, that's just regular scorpions. I mean, it's a very dangerous scorpion, but just a regular scorpion. Can you imagine the torment that these locusts will have upon men on the earth? For how long? 5 months. 5 months. These demonic creatures, I'm sure the pain that they will inflict will be much worse than anything you could think of, whether it's a dangerous or non-dangerous scorpion. Look with me in verse 6. It says, in those days, men will seek death, and they will not find it. They will desire to die, and death will flee from them. You know, if you read back in the book of Job, chapter 3, verse 22, Job was had inflicted upon him a lot of pain and suffering in this life. Certainly the loss of his servants and his family. And then the terrible pain that he had on himself with the boils that were over all of his body. He couldn't even sit or stand without some level of discomfort. And it talked about the fact, because of his sufferings, that he felt this way. He felt like he'd be better off if he died than to go through what he was going through. Now, he didn't try to kill himself or anything like that, but he certainly had those feelings of wishing he could die. Jeremiah talked about Judah when they went into captivity to Babylon. The terrible pain and affliction and sufferings that was put upon the people of Judah with the Babylonian captivity and so forth, the siege and so forth, they wished to die rather than go through that as well. We see the same attitude in Revelation chapter 6 with the sixth seal, where men are saying to the rocks, fall on us and hide us, so we don't want to face the wrath of the Lamb. So we see that here. These people, because of the pain of the fifth trumpet and the locusts that will be brought on the earth, they will not only desire to die, I think they will be actively seeking to kill themselves. They will seek death and trying to find a way to end their life. But it says they won't be able to do it. They will be prevented from doing so by God Himself, so to make sure that they will endure and will feel this pain for this entire five-month period. Now, going on to verse 7, here's where we get a real picture of the fact that these are not normal locusts, as you see at the description of them giving. And notice as we read through it, how much of the language you see that's used there indicates that there's some symbolism in here as well. He says, the shape of the locust was like horses prepared for battle. So we see that word like gives us a symbolic picture. You know, it's interesting, the shape like horses is probably actually the one feature that really does remind us of a plain, ordinary locust. If you look at it, it's got kind of a long face, like a horse. It looks kind of like that. In fact, Vincent has written about this. He says, locusts look very much like horses equipped with armor. In fact, the word locust in the German is the word, and I don't know if I pronounce it right, I mean German experts, it's H-E-U-P-F-O-R-D, or F-E-R-D, Hoopford or something, but it means hay horse. The word for locust means hay horse. The Italian word is cavalletta, and it means little horse. So they must look like a horse in the face a little bit. But it says, these look like horses prepared for battle. Their shape was like that. For the next portion, it says, on their heads were crowns of something like gold. Say it was gold, but something like gold. Their faces were like the faces of men. Now, there are some unattractive men in the world, I'm sure, but locusts don't look like men normally. This is something different. Their faces look like the faces of men. They had hair like women's hair. That's not true of locusts either. So these are something else. Their teeth were like lion's teeth. And I have never seen a bug or an insect like that that has that type of description. But that's what these look like. They had breastplates like breastplates of iron. And the sound of their wings was like the sound of chariots with many horses running into battle. There have been all sorts of ideas put forth for what these locusts are. Things that took place in the past, people thinking that these prophecies are already fulfilled, things that will maybe take place in the future, thinking that these are tanks or something like that, all sorts of different ideas that people have come up with. But the key thing there is what he says in verse 10. He says, they had tails like scorpions, and there were stings in their tails, and their power was to hurt men 4 or 5 months. So he simply reiterates, this is the key feature about them, is that they are like scorpions, and the sting of their tails torments men for 5 months. Now, it's interesting, if you read the description of the four living creatures over in Revelation chapter 4 that surround the throne of God in heaven, they are, I believe, the cherubim there, there's a lot of similarities. There's several similarities between those creatures and between these locusts of chapter 9. For instance, the expression like a lion, we see there's something there. A face like a man is there as well, and having wings. So there's several things that are similar. So some believe that it's possible, and this is just a thought, that these demonic locusts are kind of like an imitation of God's cherubim. These are kind of, I guess, you would say Satan's. These Satan's demonic creatures, they're cherubim as well. And you have to remember that if these are demons, which it appears to me that they are, and we think about the cherubim, both of those are angelic creatures. They were angelic creatures to begin with. They became fallen angels. Look at verse 11. We see one more thing about them is that they have a king. It says they had as king over them the angel of the bottomless pit, whose name in Hebrew is Abaddon, but in Greek he has the name Apollyon. Now, if you read the book of Proverbs, chapter 30, verse 27, it tells us that locusts don't have a king. You look at normal, ordinary locusts, they don't have a leader. They don't have a king. But these locusts that come up out of the pit of the abyss, they do have a king. The king is the one who is described as the angel of the bottomless pit. Now, it's possible that this is that same idea, that star that was fallen from heaven that was given the key to the bottomless pit. There's no way to know that for sure, but there's an angel who has a, over them. He is called the angel of the bottomless pit. He's given a name in both Hebrew and Greek. In Hebrew, it's Abaddon, and in Greek, it's Apollyon. In both cases, both Hebrew and Greek, the word that's given there means destruction or a destroyer, because that's what this creature does, and that's what these locusts that he unleashes on the earth, that's what they do. You know, in 2 Thessalonians chapter 2, when it talks about the man of sin, one of the titles that's given to him is the son of perdition. Perdition means exactly that: ruin, loss, waste, or destruction. So as the son of perdition, that's what the Antichrist will be characterized by, is he will be a destroyer. He will be one who will destroy. In Daniel chapter 8, when he's described as the little horn, he is described as one who will destroy wonderfully. He will destroy the mighty, and he will destroy the holy people. That's the people of Israel. That's Daniel 8, 24 and 25. Now, you might ask the question, why is he given two names? Why one name in Hebrew and one name in Greek? I think because, and this is just speculation again, but I think it indicates that the judgment of God that's described here in this fifth trumpet is going to fall equally upon both. Jew and Gentile will both face this pain and this torment of 5 months from this fifth trumpet. Look with me in the book of Romans chapter 2 for just a second. We see sort of an indication of that. When the Apostle Paul was talking to the Romans about the issue of sin, and how God holds man accountable for sin. And in chapters 2 and 3, he shows that both Jews and Gentiles have been shown to be sinners and in need of salvation. But look at verse 8. Romans chapter 2, verse 8. Verse 8, to those who are self-seeking and do not obey the truth, but obey unrighteousness, what God has in store for them is indignation and wrath, tribulation and anguish on every soul of man who does evil. Notice what he closes with. Of the Jew first and also of the Greek. That's really what we see going on in the book of the Revelation. We see exactly these things. We see the indignation and wrath of God. We see tribulation and anguish placed upon every soul of man who does evil. Because that's really what's going on in the world in those days, is the evil works of man led by, again, Satan's man, the beast or the Antichrist. Okay, go back to Revelation 9. Now look at verse 12. Look at verse 12. We see these words. It says, one woe is past. That's the fifth trumpet judgment. So if it's past already and we haven't gotten to the sixth trumpet yet, then these don't overlap. This is 5 months on this one judgment, the fifth trumpet judgment. He says, behold, still two more woes are coming after these things. So there's an order to it. The fifth trumpet lasts for 5 months. It's followed by the sixth trumpet, and then after that, seventh trumpet. So they're all coming. More woe is coming upon the earth. Now, I just wanted us to consider it for a second. These are God's judgments on the inhabitants of the earth. And we might ask the question, why must men endure such woe, such grief? Because that's what these judgments bring, is great grief. I want you to look at a verse of Scripture with me in the book of Jude. Back up one book to the book of Jude. The book of Jude is describing people who are in rebellion against God. And the sure judgment of God that fell upon those who rebelled in the past. And what he's saying in this chapter is that those who are rebelling now and will rebel in the future, that judgment of God will fall upon them as well. And one of the reasons is given down in verse 11. Notice what he says. He says, woe to them, for they have gone in the way of Cain. They have run greedily in the error of Balaam for profit, and they have perished in the rebellion of Korah. Three things he identifies there, three different people that he gives examples of. He says, they have gone in the way of Cain. Cain went his own way. When God gave directions for the bringing of an offering, a sacrifice to God to cover their sins, you can either go God's way or you can go your own way. Cain went his own way. He brought the works of his own hands, the works of the flesh. So he tried to attain a righteous standing before God according to his own works. That's self-righteousness. That's the way of Cain. The error of Balaam was a greedy error. Balaam was a prophet of God, and yet what he was seeking to do was be a prophet for money. He didn't want to be a prophet to speak for God. In fact, he tried to speak, you know, what the king of Moab wanted him to speak, and he couldn't do it. He said, I can't speak for what God wants me to. But he did everything he could for money. So he sought after worldly gain for very selfish desires on the part of Balaam. That's the error of Balaam, thinking that you can, you know, satisfy your own desires and yet still be okay with God. And that's simply not the case. And finally, they have perished in the rebellion of Korah. Korah is the one who rebelled against Aaron being the priest. He thought Aaron and Moses and Miriam were taking too much upon themselves to lead the children of Israel, and so he wanted some of that for himself. And so when his rebellion against God was brought forth, he perished. He died. He was killed by God because of his willful rebellion, his self-importance, thinking that he was more important than he should have been. Those are all forms of a lie of Satan. Satan lies to people and leads people astray with these types of ideas away from God. And so these people that are described here are rebelling against God, have rejected God's offer of life through Jesus Christ, and therefore they're going to have these woes that will come upon them. And that's what Jude says. Now, let's go back to Revelation chapter 9. The next woe trumpet is the sixth trumpet. We see that in verse 13. It says, Then the sixth angel sounded, and that literally means to sound a trumpet. And I heard a voice from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God, saying to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, release the four angels who were bound at the great river Euphrates. And so the four angels who had been prepared for the hour and day and month and year were released to kill a third of mankind. Now the number of the army of the horsemen was 200 million, and I heard the number of them. And thus I saw the horses in the vision. Those who sat on them had breastplates of fiery red, hyacinth blue, and sulfur yellow. And the heads of the horses were like the heads of lions, and out of their mouths came fire, smoke, and brimstone. And by these three plagues, a third of mankind was killed by the fire and the smoke and the brimstone which came out of their mouths. For their power is in their mouth and in their tails. For they have tails like their tails are like serpents, having heads, and with them they do harm. But the rest of mankind, who were not killed by these plagues, did not repent of the works of their hands, that they should not worship demons and idols of gold, silver, brass, stone, and wood, which can neither see nor hear nor walk. And they did not repent of their murders or their sorceries or their sexual immorality or their thefts. Now, we're not going to get through all of that, but I wanted to read it so you can get the whole picture of this sixth trumpet judgment. It's an interesting thing. The subject here are four angels and the army that is associated with them, a very large army. And what they do is they bring death to one-third of mankind. Now, the sounding of the sixth trumpet, and John immediately afterward hears a voice. The Greek word that's used there is where we get our word phone. It means a sound, a voice, a noise. The source, it says, it comes from the four horns of the golden altar, which is before God. This corresponds to the tabernacle and the temple that Israel worshipped in. There was a brazen altar that sat outside the tabernacle itself in the court. That's where they would offer the burnt offering sacrifices and shed the blood and so forth. Inside the tabernacle itself, in the holy place, there was right in front of the veil, there was a golden altar. It was a golden altar of incense. Okay? It was used, and you would go in, when the high priest would go inside the Holy of Holies, past the veil, inside the Holy of Holies, he would take inside and burn incense so that basically his presence was covered as he stood before the very presence of God. So that's what this is. In heaven, which the tabernacle and the temple were both patterned after, there is a golden altar there as well. It is called a golden altar of incense. The incense represents the prayers of the saints. We see that mentioned several times in the book of the Revelation. Look at chapter 8, for instance. Look at verse 3. It says, then another angel having a golden censer came and stood at the altar. A censer is something to hold coals of fire. He was given much incense that he should offer it with the prayers of all the saints upon the golden altar which was before the throne. So the incense is burned on that altar. Not animal sacrifices, but an incense offering is burned on that altar. But it says he offered it with the prayers of all the saints. Back up to chapter 5 for a second. We read this earlier when we saw the picture of the seven-seal scroll that Jesus, the Lamb, took. Look at verse 8 of chapter 5. When he had taken the scroll, the four living creatures and the 24 elders fell down before the Lamb, each having a harp and golden bowls full of incense, which are, or you could say, which represent the prayers of the saints. These elders, I think, are basically the priests of heaven that are there to intercede for the people, particularly the people of Israel. So they have these bowls full of incense that represent the prayers of the saints. And we saw in chapter 6, look there just real quick, in chapter 6 we saw the souls of those who had been slain, those martyrs under the altar there. And they cry out, look at verse 10, they cried with a loud voice, saying, "How long, O Lord, holy and true, until you judge and avenge our blood on those who dwell on the earth?" And they're told that they must wait a little longer until more are killed who must be killed during that period. So this, in a sense, I think, pictures the fact that this is an answer. God's judgment here, the fifth and sixth trumpets, the woe trumpets, are an answer to the prayers of those who are crying out for vengeance because of the blood that they have shed for their testimony. The fact that there are four horns, if you study that, look at the symbolism there. The horns, the word horn, speaks of authority. We see the beast is described as a little horn that rises up among seven other horns and so forth. So that speaks of authority, authority that ultimately comes from God. The number four, we talked about this before, is related to the earth itself or to the creation. So this is something, a judgment that's going to take place when they threw fire down to the earth. It's a judgment from God that comes upon the earth. So there's a voice from that altar of incense, that golden altar of incense in heaven. Whose voice it is, it doesn't say. I mean, there's lots of different ideas. Some believe that it's one of the four living creatures. They're certainly active in a lot of these judgments. Some believe that it's Christ himself, the one who loosed the seals. Although we haven't seen his voice anywhere else in regard to these trumpet judgments. Some believe it's the angel that we just read about in Revelation chapter 8, the one who had the golden censer, filled it with fire from the altar, and threw it to the earth. Some believe that it's that. I don't know. Certainly a voice that speaks for God in this. We know that as well. Today, in this present age of grace, it's interesting. We really see the silence of God. Now, we don't see God speaking today. We see God's silence. There's a wonderful book by Robert Anderson called The Silence of God. He talks about this dispensation of God's grace, the truth of the mystery, and talks about why God's not speaking today. He says, well, what do you mean God's not speaking? God is spoken, and he's given us what he wants us to know in the Scriptures. All the Scriptures have been completed. We have a full revelation. So there's not any more revelations, visions, dreams being given by God. There are people who claim that they're getting those, but there's no need for it. Not that we have a complete revelation. The word that was given to the Apostle Paul, the truth of the mystery, was given to fulfill or complete God's word. There is no direct intervention by God, I don't believe, too much in the world today. People always ask that question. Why doesn't God step in and deal with all the tragedy we see in our world, whether it's natural disasters or whether it's men, you know, bringing evil upon one another in some way or another? Look, every time I turn on Yahoo, I'm never surprised anymore that I see there's another shooting. You know, the other day, a couple of days ago, in a synagogue, and people say, why doesn't God step in and do something? God doesn't step in because God is long suffering. Okay, God is long suffering. He does not desire anyone to perish. He desires all men to be saved. And as long as he doesn't step in and start these judgments, then people have an opportunity today in this dispensation of grace to be saved by hearing and believing the gospel of God's grace. One of these days, when this dispensation comes to an end, God will speak again. In the second psalm, it talks about, well, let's look at that passage. I've talked about it before, but let's look at it. The second psalm addresses this very thing that we're seeing in the book of Revelation, at least this is a part of it, at least. Look at verse 1. It begins with a question. It begins with a question that deals with the Gentile nations and then the people of Israel. It says, Psalm 2:1, why do the nations rage? And this is rage against God, okay? Why do the people plot a vain thing? The kings of the earth set themselves, and the rulers, meaning I think the rulers of Israel, take counsel together against the Lord and against his anointed. That's the Lord Jesus Christ. We saw that when Jesus was here on this earth. We saw that Pontius Pilate, the Roman government, and the Jewish rulers all gathered together against Jesus to put him to death. Now, they didn't realize that in doing so, they were actually fulfilling God's will. That was exactly what God's will was, that Jesus Christ died on the cross. But that doesn't take away from the fact that what they did was sinful, was wicked. They take counsel together against the Lord and against His anointed, saying, let us break their bonds in pieces. Let us cast away their cords from us. In other words, let's get out from under God's control. Let's get out from under the control of the Lord Jesus Christ. We don't want them dictating what goes on in our lives. Notice the response of God. He who sits in the heavens shall do what? Laugh at the foolishness of this notion. Because we're talking about the sovereign God who is the creator of the universe, who is over all things in this universe, and ultimately controls the destiny of everything that happens in this universe. He's going to laugh at the idea that the nations and the kings of the earth and the rulers of the people of Israel could actually stand against Him and withstand Him. The Lord shall hold them in derision. And then verse 5, and then He shall speak to them. How? In His wrath. In His wrath. He will distress them in His deep displeasure. Can you imagine the fifth trumpet judgment? Will they experience distress? Yes, they will. Will they experience His wrath in this sixth trumpet judgment? Yes, they will. God will speak again one day. And when He does, it won't be an age of grace. It'll be an age of judgment and tribulation upon the earth. He shall speak to them. Go back with me to Revelation chapter 9. Look at verse 14. What does the angel say? What does the voice say? The voice that John hears from the golden altar says this, says to the sixth angel who had the trumpet, release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. Now, the one who's going to release them is the sixth angel. This is one of God's angels, okay? No question about that. They're one of the seven angels that stand before the throne of God and the presence of God there in heaven. Release the four angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. You know, if you back up with me a little bit and think back to what happened back in Revelation chapter 7, we saw that there were four angels that were restrained by God, telling them that they were not to hurt anything on the earth or the people on the earth until the 144,000 had been sealed in their foreheads. So God restrained His angels from executing judgment on the earth at that time until the sealing of the 144,000 was completed. Now in Revelation chapter 9, we find four more angels that are restrained by God. Okay, they are released by God to actually inflict a judgment upon the earth. If these angels are bound, what do you think that implies about them? What kind of angels are they? These are Satan's angels. These are evil angels. These are fallen angels. I think there's no question about that. So there are four fallen angels who are bound at the great river Euphrates. Now, we saw earlier in 2 Peter 2:4, we saw that the angels who sinned were cast down to hell. And the word there is Tartarus, which means a place of incarceration, a place where they're imprisoned. They are there in chains of darkness unto the judgment of the great day. In Jude chapter 6, we saw the angels that did not keep their proper estate or proper domain, but left it and left their dwelling place. They're reserved in everlasting chains under darkness for the judgment of the great day, which I think we're looking at right now, the judgment of the great day that's described in Revelation chapter 6, verse 17. So these are fallen angels. Now, some of them are bound in Tartarus, and I think there's every reason to believe it's certainly possible that Tartarus is equivalent to the pit of the abyss. So that these angels, or these demonic creatures we see coming up in the form of locusts, they are the ones who were possibly kept in Tartarus. But there are others who are bound at a different location. That's an interesting location because it's a location here upon the earth. It is the great river Euphrates. And we ask the question, why are they bound there? What sense does that make? The Euphrates River is basically the boundary separating the east from the west in that part of the world. It runs right through modern-day Iraq and Syria. That's where that river runs. It cuts right through there. The ancient city of Babylon sat on that river, so it's very closely associated with the Babylonian kingdom and the city of Babylon. It was also a boundary that God gave to Abraham. In Genesis chapter 15, when God told Abraham to look out and look over the land, He says, I'm going to give you all the land from the great river, which is the river Euphrates, to the river of Egypt. All of that land is going to be the land that I promised to the people of Israel, and I will one day give it to them. So that's one of the things as well. The first mention of the Euphrates River, anybody want to guess what book it's in? Or where it is? Anybody know where it is? Genesis, yeah, the book of Genesis. Genesis chapter 2, when he talks about the Garden of Eden. There is a river that flows out of the Garden of Eden that separates into four separate riverheads. Now, I didn't write down all the names of all of them, but the fourth one is the Euphrates River. So if you think about that, what that tells us is that the area there by the Euphrates River, this great river, is where we find much evil. There's a lot of evil associated with it. The first sin occurs there, led by the first deception of Satan. The first murder takes place in that same area, where Cain kills his brother Abel. The first war is described in association with that, when Abraham led the kings to go out and fight and to get his nephew Lot released, who had been taken prisoner. It is the beginning of Nimrod's kingdom. You remember the story of the Tower of Babel. And the leader of that insurrection of the Tower of Babel was a man named Nimrod. He's described as a mighty hunter before the Lord. And that expression in the Hebrew, many believe that it means he was a mighty hunter who basically stood in defiance of God. He set himself up in rebellion against God. And so he's the one, I think, that it says the beginning of his kingdom was Babel, and that became Babylon. And so I think he was behind that insurrection of the people to build that Tower of Babel contrary to what God's will was for them to do. And likely that tower, as we've talked about in the past and studies of that, was probably a religious tower of some sort. It was a place of worship, not to worship God, but to worship the things that God had made, whether it was the sun, the moon, the stars, whether it was other things as well, idols and so forth. So it was very, very likely the beginning of that kingdom of Babel was the beginning of a form of idol worship, a system of idol worship that started there. It was the place that Abraham left. When God called Abraham, he lived in a place called Ur of the Chaldees. Chaldees is associated with Babel or Babylon, on the other side of the Euphrates River. In fact, if you take that word Hebrew, Abraham was described as a Hebrew. That word literally means, well, there's a couple of different ideas about where it comes from. There was a person in the lineage of Abraham who was called Eber, E-B-E-R. And so many people believe that they were called Hebrews because of that. The other idea, though, is this, that the word Hebrew literally means from beyond or crossed over. When you look at what happened with Abraham, Abraham is described in Joshua chapter 24 and verse 2 as he crossed over the river Euphrates. He left Ur of the Chaldees to go to a land God said that I will show you. God called him out of that place, called him to come to that land, and Abraham began to worship God, built altars, worshiped God, trusted God, dwelt in tents and so forth. But that may be why he was called a Hebrew, because he crossed over the Euphrates, crossed over into that land that God was going to give them, away from idolatry in that region, even though he went into idolatry in the region that of Canaan. So Abraham left that area as well. It is the place where Israel was taken into captivity. When the whole nation of Israel went into captivity, it was to Nebuchadnezzar, who was the king of Babylon. And that's where Daniel and Shadrach, Meshach, and Abednego, they were all taken there to idolatrous Babylon. And in the future, Babylon will rise again and will become the place, basically the center of wickedness and idolatry associated with the Antichrist kingdom. Look at Revelation chapter 17. Revelation chapter 17. And I'm not going to comment too much on this because we're going to go and study it, obviously, when we get there. But I want you to just look at the description of the place and what it's like. Beginning in verse 1, we're going to read down through verse 6, Revelation 17. Then one of the seven angels who had the seven bowls came and talked with me, saying to me, come and I will show you the judgment of the great harlot who sits on many waters. Now, notice, the great harlot, with whom the kings of the earth committed fornication, and the inhabitants of the earth were made drunk with the wine of her fornication. And so he carried me away in the spirit into the wilderness, and I saw a woman sitting on a scarlet beast, which was full of names of blasphemy, having seven heads and ten horns. Now, that description of that beast there is the same description you see in Revelation 13, which is the Antichrist. He rises up out of the sea. This woman, it says, was arrayed in purple and scarlet, adorned with gold and precious stones and pearls, having in her hand a golden cup full of abominations and the filthiness of her fornication. Now, the fornication here is probably two senses to it. Number one, it's probably literal fornication, physical, and it's also probably idolatry. Okay, idolatry is considered fornication against God because God is a jealous God. He doesn't want to have someone worship other gods instead of him. So both of those things are true. But notice verse 5, and on her head, this woman's head, there was a name written which said, Mystery, Babylon the Great, the mother of harlots and of the abominations of the earth. And I saw the woman drunk with the blood of the saints and with the blood of the martyrs of Jesus. So you can see what this city is going to harbor, people who have killed those who are believers in Jesus. I saw her, I marvel with great amazement. Now, in chapter 18, we see where this city is destroyed. Look at verse 1. After these things, John says, I saw another angel coming down from heaven, having great authority, and the earth was illuminated with his glory. And he cried mightily with a loud voice, saying, Babylon the Great is fallen and has become a dwelling place of who? Demons. A prison for every foul spirit, a cage for every unclean and hated bird. For all the nations have drunk of the wine of the wrath of her fornication. The kings of the earth have committed fornication with her, and the merchants of the earth have become rich through the abundance of her luxury. And I heard another voice from heaven saying, Come out of her, my people, lest you share in her sins, and lest you receive of her plagues. For her sins have reached to heaven, and God has remembered her iniquities. So Babylon in the future is going to be, again, the place where the system of idolatry that Satan has put in this world is going to be the center of that. A dwelling place of demons, sins reached up into heaven. So these four angels that are bound at this river, the river Great Euphrates, they're released. They're released. And I think, no doubt, they will unleash God's judgment upon Satan's evil world system, this system of idolatry, this city of Babylon. In that very place there where they're released. That's where it's going to begin. That doesn't mean that it doesn't go other places. That doesn't mean that it doesn't extend in other places. Because how much of mankind is going to be killed? One-third. There's going to be more, they're not going to be one-third of mankind living in that one city of Babylon. So it's going to spread from there. But it starts there, and that's very appropriate that it starts in that center. So that's why I think they're bound at the great river Euphrates, because they're going to start right at the source of this wickedness and idolatry in the world. Now, go back to Revelation chapter 9. Look at a couple of the things, and we'll stop for tonight. It says in verse 15, after he releases them, it says, So the four angels who had been prepared for the hour and the day and the month and the year were released to kill a third of mankind. There's an appointed time when they're to be released. And they'll be released at that time. Some believe that that expression, the hour and the day and the month and the year, indicates a period of time, which would make it approximately 13 months. Okay? Approximately 13 months. And they believe that because of the previous judgment, the fifth trumpet, we see it's a specific period of time. It's 5 months. And there's no reason to believe that that's symbolic in any way. Or this either. But I don't think this is a period of time here. This is a point in time. This is going to happen at God's appointed time. It's like when the Lord Jesus Christ came into this world. He came when the fullness of the time. When the fullness of the time had come, God sent forth His Son. At the exact time God wanted it to happen. That's what we see here. The appointed time. And the appointed task is to do this. Is to kill one third of mankind. Now, we've already seen that percentage in the earlier judgments. With the first four trumpet judgments. Judgments on a third of the earth, whether it was a third of the green grass, or a third of the trees, or a third of the ocean, or a third of the rivers and the valleys and so forth, or a third of the lights in heavens, the third there. This is on a third of mankind, the inhabitants of the earth. Not just to torment them, but this is death. These people will, in a sense, get what they wanted during the fifth trumpet. They will die. They will actually be killed. Think of the massive number of people that will be. I looked up the other day and it said that we're roughly 7.6 billion people in our world today. Now, I don't know if that's growing or what, but I know it must be growing because I looked several years. When I taught this lesson several years ago, it was a much smaller number. But let's round it off and let's say it's approximately 8 billion people. Now, people say, well, what about when the rapture comes? When the rapture comes, a lot of people will be gone. I wish that were the case, and I pray that it is the case, but I just don't know if it's going to impact that figure that much. I just don't know if there are that many true believers in the world today. So let's just take the figure of 8 billion people and say, what does this amount to? That amounts to approximately 2 2/3 billion. 2.66 billion people would die if that's how many are on the earth at that time in that judgment. That's an almost unbelievable figure to think about. We think about disasters and coming. When we read about disasters, a typhoon or something, and we think of hundreds of people killed, or maybe even 1,000 people killed. This is not 1,000. Not in the thousands. This is not in the millions. This is over 2 billion people that will die. Now, that's assuming something. There are some who believe that there's another judgment that's going to wipe out more even before this happens. Go back with me to Revelation chapter 6 for just a second. Now, I'm not real sure about this, and I'm not, but I'll give you the numbers and you can think about it. Look at verse 7, the fourth seal. Revelation 6, 7. When he had opened the fourth seal, I heard the voice of the fourth living creature saying, "Come and see." And so John says, "I looked, and behold, a pale horse, and the name of he who sat on it was Death, and Hades followed with him." That's hell. "And power was given over them, over a fourth of the earth, to kill with sword, with hunger, with death, and by the beasts of the earth." Now, it doesn't say that they will kill a fourth of mankind. Many people interpret it that way. There are a lot of people who do. They say that they're given power to kill over a fourth of the earth, meaning, I think, a fourth of the area of the earth. They will go out to kill with the sword, with hunger, with death, and with the beasts of the earth. That's prophesied in the Old Testament scriptures. But let's say it is true that a fourth of mankind dies here. Okay? So that would break us down, that would take us down from 8 billion to what? 6. That would take out 2 billion right there, fourth. Now, so 6 billion left, and how many are hit with the next judgment? A third, which takes us down another 2 billion. And that's from 8 billion to 4 billion, half of mankind destroyed with those two plagues, if that's what this means. I don't know that that's what this means. But just the numbers of 2.66 billion is just staggering. The judgment of the sixth trumpet carried out is carried out not just by the four angels, though. There is an army that goes with them. Look with me at verse 16. Go back to Revelation 9, verse 16. And this is what we'll talk about next time. He says, "Now the number of the army of the horsemen was 200 million. And he says, "I heard the number of them. And I saw the horses in the vision, and those who sat on them." And it described them. We won't read the description again. So you've got horsemen here. How many? 200 million. 200 million. That is a massive army. That is a larger army than any that has ever been fielded on the earth at any time. In World War II, for instance, both the Allies and the Axis sides of the army had armies that were in the range of about 70 million. This is almost three times that much. This is a massive army. The question is, who are they? We don't give a whole lot of description here. It just says the number of the army. There's an army here. All of a sudden, there's an army here. There were four angels. We got the number there. That's just four. But all of a sudden, there's an army that's there with them. The question is, who are they? That's what we'll look at next Sunday night as we finish out looking at the plague. Who they are, what the description is like, what they do, and what's the response? What's the response after this judgment comes upon the earth? And so we'll pick up there next time, the Lord willing.